I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, the question of leadership at Harvard University. But first, President Bush delivered a speech in Brussels, Belgium today, saying Europe and the U.S. should move beyond past differences and work together to spread democracy around the world. This evening, the president caps his second day in Brussels with a dinner in honor of French President Jacques Chirac. Christopher Dickey is Paris bureau chief and Mideast regional editor for Newsweek magazine. He joins us now from Paris. Chris, hello.
Hi, Robin.
And the president began his speech by comparing, humorously, his visit to Europe with Benjamin Franklin's arrival there 200 years ago. President Bush said an observer at the time said that Franklin was more popular than Sir Isaac Newton and other luminaries.
The observer went on to say there was scarcely a peasant or a citizen who did not consider him as a friend to humankind. I've been hoping for a similar reception. But Secretary Rice told me I should be a realist.
Chris Dickey, a nice icebreaker. And the president's speech did seem to be high on ideals. But what about the realism? How would you characterize the speech, and how do you think it played in Europe?
I think certainly the atmospherics were good. You heard there was a lot of laughter at that joke, and there was a lot of applause for the speech, although it was a very carefully selected audience. Generally, I think people are ready to see the United States turn the page and see European and American relations move forward. On the other hand, I think there's a lot of reservations about the kind of idealism that's being proposed by the president, not because Europeans are hostile to liberty and freedom, but because idealism sometimes sounds like ideology on this side of the Atlantic, and high-flying ideology has been the cause for a lot of trouble in this part of the world, dating back for hundreds of years.
And do the Europeans in general view the president as sincere in his idealism, in other words, in trying to bring democracy, for instance, to the Middle East?
I think that they think he's sincere. I think they think he's sincere on a couple of fronts. Yes, they think that he wants to impose democracy, if that's what it takes, on the Middle East. But they also tend to think that he's hot-headed, that he's a warmonger, that he's willing to use force at times when it doesn't need to be used. And the overall opinion of the president among the European public is extremely negative because of all that.
Well, Chris, we've been drawing up a list of the issues that the president touched on. Throw in some of yours as well. Iraq and training of Iraqi troops, even by countries who may not have led to the fall of Saddam Hussein, getting Syria out of Lebanon, Russia and democracy. What were some that you saw?
Well, I think the training of Iraqi troops is insignificant. It is purely a cosmetic gesture. It's not training them on the ground in Iraq. It's not deploying more European troops to Iraq. It's not really taking much of the burden off of the 130,000 to 150,000 American troops who are in Iraq doing the bloody job of trying to keep the peace and impose peace. On the other hand, I think that you're going to see some real movement on the Syrian front, or at least there's a possibility of it. France has been very committed to trying to get Syria out of Lebanon. French President Jacques Chirac was very, very close to former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, who was blown up a few days ago in Lebanon, and whose death has started a whole movement in the streets of Lebanon to get the Syrians out. And you may have a situation where where Chirac tonight, when he meets with Bush, is going to be hotter for conflict, more aggressive on Syria and Lebanon than President Bush is likely to be.
Christopher Dickey, just a few seconds we have. Brussels, as we said, is where the meeting is, capital of the European Union, headquarters of the NATO alliance. Is the venue perhaps also part of the message?
Well, it is to the extent that that the United States would like to say, we're dealing with Europe now. We're dealing not with the old or the new Europe. We're dealing with the united Europe now. And I think that's a way of turning the page. It also encourages the European experiment with building a constitution and eventually, soon, having a European foreign minister. So I think all of that is symbolic and important and helps to sort of put the ugly transatlantic relations of the last couple of years behind us.
Christopher Dickey, Paris bureau chief and Mideast regional editor for Newsweek magazine. Chris, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
Here in Boston, the Harvard University faculty meets tomorrow to discuss calls for President Lawrence Summers to resign because of comments he made at an economic conference last month, musing out loud that innate abilities rather than socialization might explain the lack of women in the sciences. Well, we're going to speak in a moment with attorney Harvey Silverglate, who says Summers is only guilty of being politically incorrect. But first, joining us on the line from Cambridge, Professor Everett Mendelson. He teaches the history of science at Harvard. And Professor Mendelson, you've been one of Dr. Summers' strongest critics. What do you think this is about?
My sense is that what we're watching at Harvard is an issue much deeper than just the question of the talk that he gave at the National Bureau of Economic Research. We're looking more deeply at the issue of leadership and governance.
And how do his comments fall into that category?
They fall in the sense that they just catalyze the most recent place where he has seemed to miss the cues as to what it is that people are worried about and thinking about in terms of his own presidency, in terms of his own leadership. Sure, we're worried about the role of women in science and mathematics, women in high-powered professions in general, which he discussed. But the underlying issue here is what it is that's going on at Harvard. At the moment, in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, of the 463 tenured members, 86 are women. During the past 3 years, during Summers' leadership, the percentage of women appointed to tenure has dropped each year. And this past year, of 32 appointed to tenure, 4 were women. There's a problem. And it's in the context of that problem that people greeted Summers' musings with the kind of critique that emerged.
Do you think he had the right to question whether or not innate ability might impact women's going into the sciences as opposed to socialization?
He certainly has the right to question it. Let me just be very clear. I came to my intellectual age during the McCarthy years, and I think I have had a deep commitment to academic freedom, civil liberty since then. I don't think you'd find a single professor at Harvard who would say that he hadn't the right to raise those questions. I think having raised them, and having raised them in what seemed to me in reading his text, which finally came out in a sloppy manner, that he has to face the kind of commentary and critique which we would give any individual who raised issues in that way. The fact that he was president at Harvard at the time that Harvard has real problems just heightened the sensitivity.
Do you agree with some of your colleagues who are saying he may have the right, we all have the right to freedom of speech, but a Harvard University president doesn't have the right to be, in their view, uninformed, that there is research that contradicts what he was saying, and as a Harvard University president, he could, more than anyone, have gotten his hands on it?
He certainly has the right to be uninformed, but to speak on an issue in which he is involved and where his leadership makes a big difference and still be uninformed is not a place I would want to be. I mean, if I were Larry Summers, I would worry about the fact that the most notable piece that he has ever written will be on women in science. That's not where I'd want to be. It's not a good piece, wasn't thoughtful, wasn't well-researched, nor is it his field. He was musing out loud in an area which is filled with minefields. Let me put it very bluntly. When you make a scientific hypothesis, the outcome of which can be prejudicial to one group or another, you raise the bar of evidence very high, and you raise the preciseness with which you introduce the issue.
Some of Lawrence Summers' defenders, I'm thinking of a column in yesterday's Boston Globe, are saying he's done great things for the school. He's shaken up a staid environment. He's been determinedly and deliberately provoking, and in so doing has made good changes.
I think Lawrence Summers has been consciously provoking. He came to Harvard. It was announced by the governing board to shake things up. I've been at Harvard a long time. I watched what's been going on here. Harvard was not broke when he came. This was a lively place, and I think he came in with a sense that no one else understood what a university should be or what it could be. Harvard was vibrant when he came. Sure, we can change. always should change. We've been changing for over 350 years. But a president of a university ought to recognize that part of the process of change involves real communication with the community that he's a part of. And that really didn't happen nearly well enough.
We've left out yet another controversial chapter in Mr. Summers' story, which is his interaction with some African-American professors at Harvard, one in particular, Cornel West. Summers' supporters say that he addressed a professor who wasn't contributing as much as he should. Others say he made a huge mistake and the university lost a terrific professor who left.
Cornel West was a very significant public intellectual. To come in and within 2 months of his tenure as president, fairly directly insult a leading figure, not enter into consultation with him, and then, in a sense, push him out, left the African-American program here badly wounded. Others left. It's very difficult to recruit new people. Larry Summers, probably inadvertently, but in part because of a confrontational nature, somehow misunderstood the situation in another of those areas where it is important to understand what you're doing, what you're saying, and what the impact will be.
So what do you think, Professor Mendelson? Do you think that President Summers should resign?
I think the issue of resignation in part is up to him, in part is up to the corporation, Harvard's governing board.
Who, by the way, have said they stand behind him.
The statement they put out indeed stood behind him, but I read it, and it's hardly an unqualified support. In part, their statement was a direct response to the call at our faculty meeting a week ago to ask, where in the world is the corporation? I asked it myself. I said, was the corporation leaving Larry out there to dangle in the breeze? They had to speak. They could do no less. What they didn't do is address the underlying questions. And they know what they are. They are underlying questions of governance, underlying questions of their responsibility, underlying questions of an extremely hierarchical institution in which the move toward greater centralization hierarchy was only exacerbating problems on the ground. I would say that if he comes to find that there is a significant lack of confidence in his ability to lead and that he doesn't see a real way to overcome that lack of confidence, he'll have to make the judgment on that basis. You can't be the president of a university community without having confidence from those in that community.
We should say over 100 Harvard professors have signed a letter of support of President Summers. You personally, do you wish he would resign?
I'm not sure. I'm listening carefully to my colleagues. I'm listening to what they say, and I'm watching the responses we get. My fundamental aim is to see governance and leadership improved at Harvard. If Larry Summers can do the job, fine. We'll have to put in place, though, institutional changes which mean that the kind of overstepping of boundaries, the kind of deeply centralized power over appointments, over committee structures, over budgets and how they're generated, these need to be made more transparent.
Everett Mendelson is professor of the history of science at Harvard University. Professor Mendelson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And just ahead, attorney Harvey Silverglate. He says Lawrence Summers has the right to provoke. And speaking of which, later in the program, a provocative VH1 special looks at white teens trying to fit into hip-hop culture. It's called Dude, Where's My Ghetto Pass? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation about academic leadership at Harvard University, we're also going to take a look at questions of academic freedom on other college campuses with civil liberties and criminal defense lawyer Harvey Silverglate, who's co-founder and board member of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And Harvey, we just heard Professor Everett Mendelson speaking critically of Harvard President Lawrence Summers' comments, including recent ones in which Summers said that innate differences were possibly the reason for the lack of women in the sciences. Now, you don't think Summers should resign. Why?
I think it would be disastrous if Larry Summers were to resign because, in fact, it wouldn't be a resignation. He would have been driven out, and he would have been driven out for expressing a point of view which is considered to be the third rail of higher academia in this country. You talk about gender or you talk about race, and either you carry the corporate line or you're out. It is the third rail, and he would have established the precedent that a university president could be driven out for saying something that was politically incorrect.
Well, but Harvey, let me ask you about that. Was it politically incorrect or inaccurate? In the later part of the speech, after the speech, questioners from the audience said, well, wait a minute, it's not just women, it's men also who can't do the 80-hour work week. And in fact, the research that you're asking for is here. It's embodied in all of us. We've done this research. So, it seems to go back to what some people are saying is an embarrassing moment for the school, that a president would be musing about something that's already been researched.
Quite the opposite. When the full transcript was released, and of course the full transcript, it's too bad he couldn't release it earlier, but this conference was held under an assumption that it would not be made public, and he tried to adhere to that. But when he released the transcript, his position got much stronger, because in the talk, he referred to research on both sides of this, and he referred to research that had been discussed earlier in this very program. He was hardly closed-minded. What the problem he had was he mentioned the possibility that some of the outcome of some of the research might not be welcomed by many in the room, and he even included himself in the group that would feel uncomfortable if some of this research came out the wrong way. But what he was saying was, unless we're willing to look at hard facts, we're not going to be able to come up with effective solutions. Well, I don't see how one could be criticized for that.
Well, Harvey, speaking about unpopular speech, we want to take a look at two other incidents on college campuses. First, to the Middle East Studies program at Columbia University in New York. A controversy there involves a documentary in which Jewish students claim that several Palestinian professors intimidated them based on some sketchy incidents. For instance, one student says she was asked to leave a classroom after a disagreement. The professor denies that. Now there's a faculty panel investigating that and other incidents. Your thoughts?
The claim at Columbia is that there is a single point of view that is imbued in the Middle Eastern Studies department. And anybody who, a student or a professor, who dissents from that orthodoxy gets in trouble or is somehow shut up. That's the charge. And there is a committee that is, by the way, not a terribly balanced committee, but a committee appointed by the administration to look into that charge. And the problem at Columbia is not unlike and not unrelated to the problem at Harvard. The problem is simply this. There are certain orthodoxies that one has to abide by and claim to believe in and support on college campuses. Otherwise, you're marginalized and shut up. Larry Summers walked into this very problem at Harvard, and students at Columbia who differ from the official university point of view on the Middle East have run into it at Columbia. And you've got it. It's all over the country in our academic communities. Orthodox positions that if you deviate from them, you're not seen as a dissenter. You're seen as somebody who is somehow immoral, wrong, beyond the pale. That's the phenomenon.
Well, let's turn to the University of Colorado, where the ethnic studies professor Ward Churchill has become a lightning rod for comparing financiers killed in the World Trade Towers on 9/11 to little Eichmanns, Nazis who deserved their deaths. The university is reviewing his academic record. It's unpopular speech, as you've been supporting unpopular speech. How can you support that?
Oh, it's very easy to support Professor Churchill. I support Professor Churchill for the same reason that I support the students at Columbia, for the same reason that I support President Summers at Harvard. And that is to say, there should not be official orthodox positions on campuses of higher education, deviation from which is the cause for firing or for censorship or simply shutting you up. And I do consider what's interesting about the Churchill case is at Harvard, it's really the left battering the right. And at Columbia, it's the left battering the right, something that's been going on in our campuses for the last 20 or 25 years with speech codes for speech that is considered to be, insulting to minority groups and so forth. Now, the worm has turned. I think it's partly as a result of the 9/11 disaster. There is a sense in some campuses now that speech from the left has gone too far. It's become unpatriotic. We have to start punishing it. And that's what Churchill ran into. He said something very unpopular, rather ugly in my opinion, but he has academic freedom, which protects his right to say it. Believe it or not, there are legislators who have called his speech hate speech, and they're looking to fire him for, quote, hate speech.
Well, some people would find that very believable when you call people who died in 9/11 Nazis.
Yes, but of course, hate speech is constitutionally protected out here on the street. The Supreme Court has been very clear that so-called hate speech is constitutionally protected. If it's protected out here on Main Street, why should it not be protected in what's supposed to be the bastion of academic freedom, our colleges and universities?
Well, I guess the answer would be people don't send their kids to school to hear hate speech.
Well,
out on the street is one thing, but
when you send your kid to a liberal arts institution, you should understand that he or she is going to be exposed to all manner and kind of points of view, some of which might make the student uncomfortable, some of which are outrageous, but all of which are protected by the First Amendment and by academic freedom.
Well, it is a topic we are going to revisit. Harvey, thank you. Civil liberties and criminal defense lawyers Harvey Silverglate is co-founder and board member of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education and co-author of The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on American Campuses. And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, from Buster the Bunny to the resignation of PBS President Pat Mitchell, the future of public television. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On this President's Day, we're thumbing through a book called Secret Lives of the U.S. Presidents, What Your Teachers Never Told You About the Men of the White House. And hoo boy. It's written by Cormac O'Brien, who joins us on the line from New Jersey. Cormac, you did not pull any punches.
No. It's meant to principally be an entertainment. And so it's also a reminder that these are, after all, human beings just like the rest of us.
Presidents are people, too. Well,
sure.
Let's start with the first three. You address questions such as George Washington's sterility, John Adams' habit of starting the day with a good stiff drink, and Thomas Jefferson's wandering eye. what are some that jumped out to you?
Well, there are a lot. Of course, going back to George Washington, one of the things that fascinated me most was that he did not, in fact, have wooden teeth. Most of them were made out of animal bone, particularly hippopotamus bone, which unfortunately was porous, extremely porous, and as a result would absorb so much of the Madeira wine he was fond of drinking. And as a result, of course, his dentures would be black in time, which is one of the very good reasons he didn't smile very much.
And in fact, there is a level of alcohol abuse that seems to run through the book.
Yes, there is. It seems to come for many of these men with the office, or perhaps just with their position in life. John Adams, of course, liked to start most days, particularly when he was on his farm in Massachusetts, with a glass of hard cider, which he made on site. George Washington, of course, had a distillery. He also had a vast wine collection. Most of the 18th century and early 19th century presidents had a great fondness for liquor and wine and beer. And for years and years, of course, whiskey was virtually the official drink of America. So that by the time you get to a man like Franklin Pierce, alcoholism is not that rare for men of of ability and substance. He ended up, of course, being called, by his friends, a hero of many a well-fought battle, and was actually quoted as saying, when he lost a nomination for a second run, well, there's nothing left to do but get drunk.
Well, there you go. Your book features anecdotes like that, hard basic facts, you know, who was their running mate, their nicknames, the dates of the term. But famous quotes, one that we like, James Buchanan, who said to Abraham Lincoln as Buchanan was leaving the White House, "My dear sir, if you are as happy on entering the White House as I am upon leaving it, you are a very happy man indeed." And why was Buchanan so, obviously unhappy?
To this day, the vast majority of historians and even, you know, just ordinary history buffs would rank him as pretty much our worst or very near the bottom, mostly because, of course, he did next to nothing while the country unraveled into a civil war. And I do have a special place in my heart for Buchanan, mainly because being a very strict jurist and a very accomplished lawyer, he acquired a fortune at lawyering long before he became president. He interpreted the Constitution quite literally, which a lot of people in his party did at the time. As a result, while he despised the South for seceding, he didn't believe there was a compelling legal means for him to stop them from doing so. So his argument was, listen, pass some legislation to allow me to do something about it, but until then, I'm just as out of line as they are if I do something about it, which, of course, Lincoln ran rather fast and loose with the Constitution and did what he thought was necessary to bring the country back together, but it wasn't strictly legal.
Look, turning to the First Ladies for a second, fascinating tidbits. Dolly Payne Todd Madison was the first to serve ice cream at presidential receptions, spent her final years in virtual bankruptcy. Julia Gardner Tyler, second wife of the 10th president, liked to call herself Mrs. Presidentress, and hold receptions in which she was seated on a throne surrounded by female friends and relatives with a wreath of flowers upon her head.
Yes, she was something else.
And tell us something else about First Ladies that you discovered that you didn't know before.
Something that interested me about Eleanor Roosevelt, she was compelled by the FBI for security reasons to carry a revolver. And because she was touring the country and meeting all kinds of people and being in the middle of throngs all across America, it seemed like a wise thing to do. And at the request of J. Edgar Hoover, she went and practiced firing with it. And apparently it was an absolutely terrible shot. While J. Edgar Hoover went back to Franklin and said, "Your wife is an absolutely appalling shot," she carried the gun, but it came to all of them that it was best that she didn't keep it loaded.
You've also published separately from the book a deck of playing cards, a sort of trivia game about presidents. I'm going to be terrible at this, but ask me a couple of the questions on your cards. Let's see how we do here, and our listeners get a chance, too.
Okay. Well, this is one about Rutherford B. Hayes.
Okay.
Seafood and steaks are common fare at White House meals, but there was one item that the Hayes administration always refused to serve. What was it?
You know, I knew that at one time. No, I have no idea what that is. What is the answer?
Alcohol.
Oh.
It was the first absolutely dry White House. And Mrs. Hayes, of course, will go down in history as Lemonade Lucy.
Ending the trend of alcohol as the drink of choice for presidents.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it was quite a scandal in Washington at the time.
I'm holding another card. Here's Grover Cleveland's card. And I really want to know, Grover Cleveland became legal guardian of Frances Folsom, daughter of his late law partner, when she was 11 years old. What happened when she turned 21? What happened?
They were married.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yes. He was known to her for, you know, her entire youth as Uncle Cleve, or Uncle Jumbo, because he was a rather large guy. And he took quite a fondness to her and married while he was in the White House. He was a bachelor going in and married his, what was the equivalent of his legal niece when she was 21.
All right, then. Well, and was his first daughter, Ruth, with Frances Folsom?
Yes, and that was, she did become known as Baby Ruth.
Right. You know, it's funny. We Cleveland's great-great niece is in our listening audience, and she's written to correct me because I thought it was Babe Ruth, and it was named, and it was a candy bar that was named after the baseball player. But no, it was Baby Ruth, and it was named after Grover Cleveland's incredibly popular daughter, Ruth.
Yes. The Clevelands all were incredibly popular, particularly his his children and his wife.
Despite the fact that he married, you know, what really amounts to his foster child.
Yes, it didn't seem to scandalize the country so much as it did fascinate them.
Well, Cormac O'Brien is author of Secret Lives of the U.S. Presidents, What Your Teachers Never Told You About the Men of the White House. And your favorite president, just for kind of the oddness factor?
The oddness factor, I imagine, would have to be Warren Harding, who didn't want to become president, I don't think, in the first place. And upon getting there, he was confused and terrified at his own ignorance and spent most of his time sleeping with his mistresses, particularly Nan Britton, or playing poker and drinking illegal booze on the second level of the White House.
Okay, you got me. The Warren G. Harding card. After finding himself out of chips on one night of poker, what did he use to make a bet? What did he use?
He used a box of White House china, and he lost it.
Well, Cormac, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So it's Harding, lead the GOP. Harding, on to victory. We're here to make a fuss. Warren Harding, you're the man for us.
And a reverent look at teens and race is coming up here and now.
Coolidge right behind you, and Coolidge never fails, you must agree.
A 28-year-old conceptual artist from San Francisco is traveling cross-country to find dinner companions. It all started when Mark Horowitz was working as a photo assistant on a Crate and Barrel catalog shoot. He thought the dry erase board in a layout looked too blank, so he decided to fill it with his cell phone number. Who would notice? Well, thousands of people who called the number, and now Mark is driving around the country in his mini RV to meet them for dinner. And Mark Horowitz joins us on the line from outside Los Angeles, Mark?
Yes, in San Diego.
And where are you now?
I'm actually in a car wash. We had to park underneath a car wash with the RV because the RV is taking in a lot of water.
Because it's raining.
It's raining horribly.
So right there, it doesn't sound perhaps as luxurious a trip as one might imagine.
No, you know, there's trials and tribulations along the way, but I think just build stronger character, really.
Well, what brought you to San Diego?
I have a dinner here with a couple, Brad and Genoa, who own a hotel here, and so I'm going to have dinner with them.
Now, how many people called you, Mark?
I would estimate anywhere from 12 to 15,000 people. Recently, the Associated Press published an article, and it got picked up by maybe 150 newspapers across the country. And so I've been starting to get a lot of calls from small towns, just a lot of very interesting people. This woman who, she has a pooper scooper business, and she travels to do it, and she said she does it to be closer to dogs because she loves dogs.
Well, yeah. And I'm reading, too, on your weblog, you write about a dinner you had with an organic chicken farmer from Los Lomas who was the winner of the 1998 Turkey Testicle Festival in Turlock, California.
The chicken farmer was awesome. They were a great couple. He was an ex-Marine who turned an organic chicken farmer, and his wife managed the farm. And, you know, I was out there in the morning helping them with stuff. I was overturning their compost pile, pulling all the chicken pens, and picking up chickens, getting eggs. It was an amazing dinner.
Wasn't one of the callers, one of the thousands of people who called, coincidentally your eighth-grade girlfriend?
Oh, my gosh, yes, and I just met her in Los Angeles. It was the weirdest thing. I went and met with her, and she has this video of me doing the Humpty Dance in eighth grade, all these love letters that I wrote her, cataloged in this little envelope. It was a very bizarre experience.
Why are you going to meet them?
I'm an artist, and I look at this project as being sort of like a Rothko painting. Like, he would lay color fields next to each other. So basically, I'm just taking the dinner concept as he took color fields and just taking it to this extreme level of traveling across the country, meeting with strangers for dinner.
Well, and we know it's not the first time you've done something like this for art. Last year, you ran errands with strangers?
Oh, yeah, that was fun. Yeah, I took, basically I started a project called the Errand Feasibility Study, and I started going on errands with strangers and either helped them fold their laundry or taught them, you know, how to fix their car, or we went grocery shopping and I helped them pick out which cereal. From that, it kind of led to the second phase, which was to ride a pack mule through San Francisco to do my errands, and that was in an effort to kind of break down barriers that people form in doing mundane activities,
right,
like errands.
Well, it would follow. not?
Physically, of course.
You will get on a pack mule. But, Mark, how do you manage this? Are you independently wealthy? I mean, how do you... What happens to your income when you're doing these things?
I wish. It would be really wonderful if I was independently wealthy. But, no, you know, I guess I had... I sold all of my stuff in a garage sale before I left. Then I sold my truck and bought this little miniature RV, which I had to fix up. And off I went. There's a donation section on my webpage, and oddly enough, people have been donating to the cause.
Well, and we know that you are filming this for a possible documentary. But we wonder, too, I mean, you would think this all started with the Crate and Barrel ad. Are they capitalizing on it?
No. Matter of fact, Crate and Barrel let me go. They didn't want to have anything to do with it.
Well, Mark, the question, you know, that's begged at this point, do you want me to give out your phone number? I feel a little weird giving out your cell phone number.
No, please. Please, by all means.
Really?
I would really love it, actually. The more people that are interested, the better this project's going to be. I mean, I think that these people that call in, they just feel like they're part of something really, really massive, and it's very exciting.
All right. It's rare that we do that, but for a good time, call 510-872-7326. You'll meet Mark Horowitz somewhere on his cell phone, somewhere in the U.S. Mark, thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
And for more on Mark and his national dinner tour, visit our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Updating today's top stories, Palestinian families cheered as the State of Israel released 500 of more than 8,000 Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. Those freed were not involved in attacks on Israelis, and Israeli officials are promising to release 400 more prisoners in the next few months. On the first day of his five-day European fence-mending trip, President Bush shared his optimism.
After many false starts and dashed hopes and stolen lives, a settlement of the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians is now within reach.
President Bush also said he will send Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to London next week to attend an international conference aimed at helping the Palestinian Authority reform its finances and security. Well, the group Ego Trip is a multicultural quintet of media mavericks who made it onto Entertainment Weekly's Top 25 Funniest People in America list. And tonight, the group teams up with producers at VH1 for the first of three programs on race. Tonight's episode is called Dude, Where's My Ghetto Pass? The huge cast features black DJs, comics, and rappers discussing white kids who try to be black.
A good definition of a wigger would be that kid that everybody went to school with, and his name was White Mike. There's a White Mike in every neighborhood. That was the wigger.
They sag a little too much. They swag a little too much. They yo. Once you go beyond the three yo's and you're white, you're wigging it. You're wigging it.
Some clips from Dude, Where's My Ghetto Pass, which airs tonight on VH1, part of a collaborative effort between the cable station and the satirical group Ego Trip. Joining us on the line from Los Angeles, Elliot Wilson, one of the founders of Ego Trip. Hi, Elliot.
How you doing, Robin?
I'm fine. What are you saying? What are you saying in Dude, Where's My Ghetto Pass?
We're just talking about how there seems to be a big trend now of Caucasian kids really trying to adapt to black culture. And from buying the music and enjoying the culture, they want to be a part of it. And sometimes there's a certain awkwardness in that exchange.
Well, I'll say. We see quite a bit of it in the program. Let's hear another clip from Dude, Where's My Ghetto Pass? Some blacks and whites are asked, why is so much of pop culture lifted from black neighborhoods? And here are some of the answers.
Pop culture embraces the hood because that's where the flavor comes from.
It's because the style, the energy that comes from the hood is so strong.
Black people are flavor. We just add spice to the game.
Us white people, we don't really have anything cultural to identify with. It's really boring. So you see these other cultures that have all these wonderful things, and you want to be a part of it.
White culture is really boring. Is that
all white culture, but, you know.
Well, apparently,
I do think a lot of white kids don't really grow up with a sense of culture, and I think sometimes if they don't really have that, they are attracted to black culture because you see a lot of black people or Latin people excelling in things that are attractive to especially young kids, which is athletics and music.
I thought I saw sort of, you know, a seriousness underlying some of the show tonight, you know.
I think that's the ability you have as a pop cultural critic is to educate and entertain. I think we do both. I think there's a certain seriousness to what we do. But at the same time, we always felt that humor is the thing that draws people in so that they'll listen. They'll listen and learn, you know. And, I mean, it's okay to love a culture, but you should not lose sense of who you are, whether you're white, whether you're black, or whether you're anything. You know, you need to be in tune with who you are and what culture you represent. And you can like other cultures and respect, as long as you have a healthy respect for them, you know, you haven't crossed any line.
Well, a part of what the program does is grant ghetto passes to various white people. It's President's Day, so we should point out that Lincoln gets a big ghetto pass. So does Bill Clinton.
Yeah, Bill Clinton. Well, I think it's a fascination that America, I mean, especially people of color in America, have gravitated and loved certain presidents, and I think Bill Clinton was one of them.
In fact, a member of your cast says of Bill Clinton, you know, he beat up his stepdad, he grew up poor. That's
black. Yeah.
But also, in the same hand, somebody else said, get out of Harlem, that's gentrification, which is in reference to Clinton setting up his office in Harlem after he was president.
Yeah, well, it just shows you that everybody is a viewpoint and there's a counterpoint. And I think, you know, it's up to you as an educated viewer to get what you want out of the program. I mean, I think that we create art and we explore topics, but then we're not really trying to tell anyone to feel a certain way. I think we're just trying to really explore the oddities that exist.
Ghetto passes, or again, you know, thumbs up, if you will, are also given to artists. Hall & Oates get one. Sting does sort of get a thumbs up, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's one fascination we discovered. You know, you look at certain white artists through the years have been embraced by the black culture. You look at someone singing like Tina Marie. When she came out in her career, she was a protege of Rick James. Many people didn't even believe that she was white because of her musical vocal range. And, you know, she is someone who we said in our show gets a ghetto pass because what that really just means is that a person who isn't black or isn't Latin or isn't from the hood or the community, a poor community, gets respect from those people.
On the other hand, Justin Timberlake had his ghetto pass revoked.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of controversy with, you know, Janet Jackson, where does Justin distance himself from Janet? And because of that, the urban community then felt betrayed because, you know, why should Janet be alone and taking the fall? He's the one who ripped the thing from her chest. I mean, if anyone's to blame, they both should be held accountable to a certain extent. And they weren't. Justin apologized and went to the Grammys, and Janet was vilified.
No ghetto pass for Justin. Well, Elliot, here's the portion of the interview where I have to ask the serious questions.
Okay.
A very funny show. But, you know, as you know, I'm guessing that there are members of the black community who are going to be appalled by this.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
Who are going
to
say
something for everyone to be offended by.
But in part, they're going to say ghetto pass just reconfirms what people think, that all black people are poor and live in the ghetto and that they can't speak English. And Bill Cosby comes to mind, you know, his criticism. What are you trying to say about that?
Well, I think that, you know, hip-hop culture has become this pop culture phenomenon, and I think with hip-hop comes those issues of authenticity and credibility and being embraced by the ghetto. So like it or not, you know, even, you know, there's the biggest separation is in the African-American community from the older generation to the younger generation. But what the Bill Cosbys of the world have to understand is that hip-hop music isn't going away, so we need to improve the communication between the generation gap.
But I guess I'm saying, how do you feel about the criticism that some of the people in your film who talk about the gangster culture that they're so proud of and, you know, say in somewhat light moments to white kids, don't come to my neighborhood because I'll beat you up, that while they may have created this culture, if they keep acting it, they're going to remain behind in the ghetto, and the white kids who pick it up for just a few minutes are going to move on in life.
Yeah, I mean, some people are really acting, but then, you know, some people are just putting out an image because that is profitable to people and appealing, and they're not really living the gangster image or really portraying that. It's just more entertainment, and sometimes you have to be intelligent enough or have enough guidance from older peers and older parents or older people to recognize the truth from the entertainment value of it.
Right. Don't take it too seriously or you might get stuck in the ghetto.
I mean, you have rappers with, you know,
a lifetime pass.
Any rapper's goal at the end of the day is the American dream story. And I think that when people of color and people that are poor and impoverished, they want to become rich one day and they want to move out the ghetto. I think that at the same time, though,
the thing exists that when you move out of the ghetto and you're successful, you want to have the ability to then still go back into the ghetto. Like Bill Cosby could go back into the poor areas of Philly that he came from and still get respect, and that's important. So I think that at the end of the day, that's what a ghetto pass really represents, is the ability to grow from your surroundings, build something better for yourself and provide for your family, but at the same time, the people, the places where you came from still love and revere you. You know, that you can go back home again.
Elliot Wilson is one-fifth of the group Ego Trip. The first of their 3 one-hour shows on race begins tonight on cable television's VH1. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Elliot, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.